So I'm going to make those sort of introductory noises that mean we're about to start. Those kind of noises. So please take your seats. We're in a very remarkable place, I must admit. We're surrounded by the museum and the objects, some of which are the true objects, some of which are kind of bits that come from further down the historical line. Then there's the exhibition, which is absolutely fascinating. I've just listened to Virginia Woolf talking about words. And then behind us is Freud's, the couch on which Freud died. It says, please do not sit on the couch. I think you could add, please do not lie on the couch. Please do not die on the couch. So, surrounded by these objects and these chairs, which also feel remarkably historic, it's an enormous pleasure to introduce and start a discussion with Andreas Meyer, who is a historian of psychoanalysis. So we are, kind of, I think we're drenched in it already, this wonderful museum and the exhibition. We're here to celebrate and discuss the publication of this book, Sights of the Unconscious, called subtitle Hypnosis and the Emergence of the Psychoanalytic Setting, which has just been published by Chicago University Press. But we can't go forward without me mentioning this book, which has also come out virtually simultaneously, yes? Within a month.
Yes.
In a different language, also by Andreas Meyer. This is called Wissenschaft vom Gehen, Die Erforschung der Bewegung im 19. Jahrhundert. This is the science of walking, the investigation of movement in the 19th century, which is another side to Andreas's activity. So let me say a little bit about Andreas. I've known him nearly 20 years. He reminded me that we first met physically in this building, when we were both chasing archival bits and pieces. We had corresponded earlier. That meeting led to extended meetings. We have met in so many different places around the world, had so many different discussions. He is a very long-term colleague in the field of the history of psychoanalysis and the history of science. For a while he was in Cambridge, where I work. I'm John Forrester, I forgot to introduce myself, but I hang out in the University of Cambridge, Department of History and Philosophy of Science. So Andreas was working there for some time, but he's worked in many different places. He had a prior career before he ended up with psychoanalysis. It's very important to mention this, because his original formation is as a musicologist, and his first book is on Schubert. And if there is one thing he loves deeply, it's Schubert, I think. So that's where he starts from, a kind of passionate commitment to music. And to Vienna, and Freud comes out, sort of Freud and Schubert sit alongside each other, you might say, in his pantheon of historical objects and perhaps love objects, perhaps other kind of objects. He worked in sociology and then became a historian of science and a scholar in science studies generally at Bielefeld. Worked in Cambridge for a while, and also in Paris at the École des Études en Sciences Sociales. He's taught in Chicago. He has the last few years been at the Max Planck Institute for the History of Science in Berlin. And he has, at the moment, he is a Heisenberg Fellow, which is an extremely eminent thing to be in Germany. But he's about to become something completely different, which is a permanent member of the staff of the CNRS, Centre National de Recherche Scientifique, in Paris, attached to the Centre Alexandre Coiré, one of these major centres for the history of science in the world. Now, his work has been obviously on Schubert, on the history of psychoanalysis. The first book in English came out about 9 years ago, I believe. Dreaming by the Book, co-written with Lydia Marinelli, who used to work in the Freud Museum in Vienna. Sadly died in 2008. Andreas and Lydia worked constantly for many years. They collaborated on papers and on a wonderful book, Dreaming by the Book, which came out a little bit after the version of, which is now English, I think that's the best way to put it. Andreas has rewritten the book completely from the German original to Sights of the Unconscious. It's turned into an English, new English book, I would basically say. He's rethought it. But in the middle, there was this wonderful book about called Dreaming by the Book with Lydia, which was an extremely innovative study of how the psychoanalytic movement began. And it began in this new version that Lydia and Andreas put together around the practice of dream interpretation and the contribution to a kind of multi-authored text, which was the interpretation of dreams as it unfolded in its series of editions from 1900 to 1909, 1911, 1914 onwards. It was a way of seeing how a scientific movement gets going. How do you start off from dreams, which seem eminently private, to the social practices of a scientific movement? Now, we're going to talk not so much about that, but we could at some point talk about that set of practices. But it's quite clear that Andreas is a wide-ranging historian, not only through his studies of walking and the science of walking, the physiology of walking in the 19th century and the early 20th century, projects on dream laboratories, obviously kind of related to psychoanalysis and dreams. But what we're really going to talk about this evening are the issues raised by his book, Sights of the Unconscious. So I made some introductory remarks about Andreas, which we can pick up on in dialogue after he's talked for a little bit. We're going to talk between us for about 35 minutes and then have an open discussion with you. So I'll hand over to Andreas and he'll talk us through his view of the book.
Thank you very much, John. I'm very pleased and honored to be here in this place, in this very special place that the Freud Museum London is, because it is, as you know, in a certain way the real Freud Museum, because all the belongings, all the objects, all the furniture and the spirit of Freud, also in a certain sense, is here in London. I also still remember this very first encounter in, I think it was 1995 or 1994, I'm not entirely sure, when I was for the very first time here in this museum and was very, very surprised by this room and by this very special atmosphere that reigns in this museum. Although I had seen the photographs by Engelmann, I had read about it, I knew a lot about it through our common friend and colleague Lydia Marinelli. But it was very hard to define what was going on in that room and the effect it had on me as a visitor. So it got me thinking and at first a bit confused, but then over the years I think I tried to turn this confusion and these feelings into questions that were historical questions or sociological questions. And one of those questions was, all those things, I mean, we are told psychoanalysis, I mean, Freud is the first to tell us, is a matter of words. It's a talking cure. to words, 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 as Freud himself writes. And Freud never talks about these concrete sites, these concrete places, these things that surround the patients. So, what are we to make of this contrast in matters of technique, of the technique of psychoanalysis, of its historical development? So that was one question that I had, and I discussed this question a lot, and crucial in many ways, John has mentioned, was Lydia's work as a curator, the way she worked at this time with the objects. And I just want to remind you, I mean, some of you know this, of course, very well, that Lydia organized an exhibition in 1889 where, for the very first time, objects from the Freud Museum London traveled to Vienna and were exposed. And this exhibition was called My Old and Dirty Gods, which is a quote from a letter to Flies, where Freud describes how he uses the statues on his desk to work on the interpretation of dreams as a kind of, what is the word in English, Briefbeschwerer, what you put on letters. Or
paperweight.
Paperweight, right. So he uses it as paperweights, a very profane task for gods. So we had, there was this question, and we kind of approached it always in dialogue, but from various angles. Lydia as a curator, but also as a historian. And that was the time when, actually, she asked me, it was her idea to travel to Paris and to investigate about Charcot's museum and Charcot's collection. It was not very well known that there was a museum, that Charcot was a collector. It was not something that was very prominent in our minds, not in my mind. So Lydia was a very careful reader of the sources. She had found this passage, and also there's a drawing by Freud. When Freud visits Charcot's home, he draws the library, and he describes the collection of Charcot in some detail with a lot of admiration. So one of the questions was, to what extent was Charcot a model for Freud in other respects, not just as the great master, as he was the great master and neurologist, but then also, as we know, as a hypnotist and fascinating figure of public life. So I did some research on the museum. I met people from the hospital archives. I went to the Salpêtrière, of course, and also got in touch slowly, because it was not so easy, with the descendants of Jean-Martin Charcot and his son Jean-Baptiste Charcot, who were very reticent, very reluctant to give me access to their archives, but then eventually I managed to look at these things, and it was really interesting and fascinating to see that there was a Musée Charcot, there was a museum in Neuilly, I mean, a bit like the Freud Museum, full with lots of stuff. I mean, most of it had been thrown away after Charcot's death or being sold. But there were all these things. There were all these things. There were Charcot's drawings, and the family did not see a lot of value in all this. They didn't. They were not very much interested in Charcot the doctor anyway, because they loved his son, Jean-Baptiste, the explorer, because he was a real hero, and this dirty stuff with the women from the Salpêtrière should be better forgotten. So they were, it's a very proper grand bourgeois family in Neuilly, so you see a bit the picture. So I said, well, but this is very valuable, this is very interesting in terms of the history of medicine, the history of psychoanalysis. So it would be very interesting to expose this in Vienna at this exhibition. So In the end, they did not allow us to use their objects or the family albums, which are very interesting. Charcot drawing. Charcot was as Freud, a passionate traveler, a grand voyageur in terms of art, and he studied works of art very closely. So in many ways, we can see Charcot has been a model for Freud. So this was in some way a first step towards the subject, the question. But then, obviously, the question was, well, to go beyond a story of great men, great figures. It's a story that will often be told from Charcot to Freud. And I think the real interest, maybe, or the distinctive feature of the book, that it tells a story that is also the story of the sites of practices, of things that are basically what one could call, with the historian of architecture, Siegfried Gideon, anonymous history. So a history that is about, not so much about the people, well, they're there as well, they're very important and instrumental in many ways, but also of instruments, of the ways sites are put to work, are transformed into experimental setups to create or to make the unconscious speak or manifest itself in various ways. In the Salpêtrière, it's a lot of noise and flashes and all sorts of electric devices and instruments, which, well, we know from this beautiful and fascinating photographs that we can see in the exhibition. But then we have also, well, all the garments and special devices, which we partly see, well, stray jackets, but then also the ovarian compressors, I mean, all these redoubtable, frightful instruments that were used by Charcot and other doctors at the Salpêtrière to trigger or to stop the hysterical attack. So this is the setting in which Freud faces hysteria and faces this entire experimental, this laboratory of hysteria, in which hypnotism plays a large role. So the book basically tells the story. I'm not going to spoil it too much for those who haven't read it yet. Some of you have already. It tells the story then in, well, closer detail, how these practices were being or tried to be transferred into German-speaking countries, to Switzerland, Austria, Germany, and how this transfer, for many reasons, failed or was not so successful, and turned out, well, in the end, in the case of Freud, becomes transformed into what we know as the familiar talking cure of the couch at its center, but clearly in a very long, winded, hopefully not too tedious fashion for prospective readers, but in a bit peripatetic mode that, so with maybe even a bit of suspense. But basically, the idea of the book is to do what historians and anthropologists of science have been doing for the natural sciences, to look at laboratories and how sites, practices were being invested and vital to the transformation of science, so thereby attacking a certain vision of science that was very disincarnate and very abstract. The standard view of science from the 1950s or 60s. So the idea was to have a vision of psychoanalysis as incarnate as we have for the sciences from the 70s, 80s. That was found that this was one of the great achievements of the laboratory studies, and to do something like a historical anthropology for the human sciences and for what we call the sciences in the largest sense of the word, the psychology, psychiatry, and psychoanalysis and other forms of mental or moral treatment. So this is then not a history of dramatic ruptures, but rather of small displacements, about gestures, techniques, transformations of practices and sites that is very concrete. And it's also not a history, well, it's not a history of great men, and it's not a history of winners or losers, as this story has often been told, of psychoanalysis superseding triumphantly hypnosis and doing away with hypnosis, because hypnosis, as you all know, is still with us and is all the rage. I mean, many people prefer hypnosis over hypnotism. I mean, one very famous French actress, who by the way played Marie Bonaparte, is completely into hypnosis. I mean, she confessed it in an interview, Catherine Deneuve, that she's not so much interested in Freud and psychoanalysis, but hypnosis is her thing. So hypnosis is still a hot topic, and not just in Paris. So it's not a history of winners and losers, but certainly of competing schools and also of competing individuals, but that I think are better seen in a larger picture of a very diverse picture, where clearly this is in the end a collective history, and this history is still not over, I mean it's still ongoing, and so I hope the book will also interest and tell something new or different to practitioners, which practitioners can of hypnosis but also of psychoanalysis can engage with and be interested in. And I think here I stop because I've talked.
So, what you said, Andreas, makes me think of raising a question which I've asked myself many times and never come to a satisfactory answer. So I want you to answer it for me, which is, why does hypnosis go through these phases? Enormous enthusiasm, and then it kind of dribbles away. I mean, it's not only your book that gives evidence of that. You just talked about it, how hypnosis, Freud discards hypnosis at a certain point in time, but he's not alone in that. A lot of people are discarding hypnosis at exactly the same moment for their own reasons, which they often say are different from the reasons that Freud gives. Freud's reasons are absolutely wonderful, instructive. I mean, he gives lots of different reasons, but one of them is that if you fail with hypnosis, then you've got no recourse. You've kind of your whole pitch as a medical authority has been based on suggestive technique, and if your suggestions fail, then you know. What do you say? You see, you've got egg on your face, and a doctor can't afford to get egg on their face. So that's one of the reasons for Freud gives for discarding hypnosis. But there are many people, Schenck-Notzing, other people like him, in the 1890s, Eugen Bleuler, I think, around the same time. They're all giving up hypnosis. And yet, 5 or 10 years earlier, hypnosis had been this great panacea, it's going to transform medicine. So what is your guess about what's going on in these movements, which are cultural and also technical in the sense of the technique of medicine?
Well, I think certainly in the beginning, one reason is certainly that the model which Freud or Bleuler or Schenck-Notzing think about hypnosis is a very hierarchical model. So it's basically the model of the leader and the crowd. I mean, because basically hypnosis is always a group at least in the 1890s, and, well, Le Bon and all this, I mean, the psychology of crowds, I mean, there's a certain political model that underpins it, and that model comes into crisis, and hypnosis reinvents itself. I mean, hypnosis also changes. I mean, this model changes, and I think nowadays, I mean, hypnosis is the model of the leader is clearly not the model anymore. I mean, it's a far more, well, maybe democratic is not the word, but it's the outlook is different. It's more, I mean, clearly, when after Charcot, I mean, the Bernheim moment and then the reinterpretation of hypnosis as being basically auto-hypnosis, so that it is the subject that basically does all the work, and it's all about the subject's almost autonomous activity, kind of the autonomy of the subject. I think that's very important. And this is very anti-psychoanalysis, because the subject is not very autonomous in psychoanalysis, because Freud keeps with a very hierarchical model, and so does Lacan. I mean, this is the model of the leader is still in place. This is, we know that many people dislike psychoanalysis because a certain hierarchical appeal, so, which has theoretical reasons and therapeutic reasons and so on. But I think in hypnosis, as hypnosis ran so quickly into difficulty and was abandoned, I think because of that model, the reshuffling of hypnosis in that sense helped it survive. I mean, that would be a fast answer.
Can I push that a little bit by saying, is that a political answer? Is it the political status of the leader or the doctor changes? And is that because of broader political shifts, or is that because of shifts within the culture of medicine or the culture of psychotherapy, which we haven't talked about, this specific thing called psychotherapy, which was for so long identified at the end of the 19th and beginning of the 20th century with suggestive therapeutics. Is this all a political story? Or is,
well, I think it's partly political, but I think a large part is how to establish and sustain the authority of this new profession, because psychotherapy is a fairly new thing. How to create a clientele. I mean, all this is in a certain sense political. But I think it's more a sociological answer than that. Yeah.
Right. Sociology, more of the professions or of the patients as well?
Of the profession and the patients, of the community of patients, how a certain collective can form and stabilize itself.
So should one also tell the history of hypnotism, psychotherapy, and psychoanalysis, the history of patients, the patient's demands or desires?
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
And do you think does that play a part in destiny of hypnosis as well?
Yes, I think it plays a large part.
Right. It's not just hypnosis and the sites, you know, the figures in your book, though. There are other experimental techniques. And I wonder if you could say something about how you see the development of psychoanalysis or psychotherapy, of which Freud is part, in relation to the experimental ideal.
Well, I mean, in the beginning, the experimental idea is clearly reproduction of, in the case of Charcot, nervous states, because for Charcot, hysteria is a set of clearly definable nervous states that you can experimentally reproduce, unfortunately only in very few subjects. But that's, for Charcot, not a problem. Because once you have bodies with which you can do that, you can rule out the problem of simulation, that these are just fake performances, which is then, well, precisely the point of the critics of Chacot, but mostly Hippolyte Bernheim, who brings in, so to speak, the criticism or the poison, the way of suggestion, saying that everything is suggestion, which is still, in a certain way, the problem of any kind of experimental form of hypnosis. If you stay with the old model of that you want reproducible states that are in the end physical states, and if you want to define hypnosis as a special state, what you can measure all sorts of things on the skin or whatever. So that's this first model, and many doctors is fascinated with this neurology, with this neurological laboratory model. But then, it's soon and completely dropped. I mean, by the end of the 1880s, early 1890s, the model is basically dead. Not because it is refuted, but because it is discredited by rumors, so that's, I think, very important to note, that Charcot's demise and also as his reputation as a scientist, is about this this destroying of his of the credibility of this experimental model, which was a thing he did late in his career. I mean, otherwise, I mean, he did all sorts of things that still stand as undisputed in the history of neurology, Parkinson's disease. I mean, there are lots of examples of diseases that are, well, not in that case, not named after Charcot, but which Charcot basically described in the way they're still. And these clinical disease entities which just still have authority. So, whereas Hippolyte Bernheim is this figure, I mean, he's this doctor from Nancy, and he's just there to destroy what Charcot and his school have built up. And usually, I mean, people telling the story of hypnotism tell the story very much from the side of Bernheim, who is the one who brings reason and enlightenment into the story, whereas Charcot is this shady figure, well, with his women at the Salpêtrière, basically faking everything, and he's falling into a sort of trap. I mean, this is a very shallow and simplistic story, which is much more complicated when you look at recording and the reports and the testimonies. It's quite a complicated story. Because obviously Charcot was not such a fool. So usually the story is told like this: well, Charcot fails, Bernheim arrives, and then in the next step we have Freud. Well, unfortunately the story is much more complicated, because in between there are other hypnotists, and they take up the experimental challenge of Charcot, but with the means of Bernheim, with speech, making speech into the patient's speech into a kind of reliable instrument, reliable tools. It's the patient who is speaking all the time, creating a kind of verbal index for his inner feelings, for his states, and so on. So that's the challenge of the 1890s, is the famous brain, and later brain anatomist, Oscar Voigt, who is very important in this, and who uses the term psychoanalysis. At the same time, Freud and Freud, they say psychische Analysen, so psychical analysis. Voigt writes psychoanalysis. So there's a competing model, which is a laboratory model, and this is the moment when Freud, in many respects, drops this laboratory model and shifts to writing, to dreams, to the wits, to slips of the tongue to things that are, well, which have a strange materiality, funny materiality, there's kind of stuff, but of a strange sort, so.
But at the end of your book, yeah, there is another experimental model, which is also very famous in the history of psychoanalysis, which is the Zurich model, very closely associated with Jung, but also yes. Bleuler and Jung. And that's the experimental model coming very strictly out of experimental psychology.
Right.
Wundt and Kraepelin, and those reaction times. Now, I was reminded how ironic that is, that Freud discards one experimental model and goes somewhere else. And then there comes this crucial historical moment in the early 1900s when suddenly he realizes, hey, there are these guys in Zurich who are interested in my work. How did that happen? I'm not sure if that's quite accurate. Certainly they are an independent operation who have far higher status and epistemic clout than Freud had in 1902 or 1904. But it's this new experimentalism.
Right.
And so how does that story work? Suddenly the Zurich school, who look as if they're going to take over psychoanalysis, which Freud wants them to take over psychoanalysis with one part of himself. But there it's a very different experimental model. And how does he negotiate, or how does psychoanalysis negotiate that?
Well, that's an interesting moment because Freud needs them institutionally, or thinks he needs them institutionally. But at the same time, well, as we know, was Freud's keeping separate from this model. So Freud never adopts the model, and he even criticizes its use at several occasions. Some of it public, some of it semi-public, like in the Wednesday Society, where it says, well, Breuer and Jung, we need them, but this association test with the reaction times, I mean, this is not real science. This is good for the psychiatrists. They will like us because this is objective. This has an objective outlook and objectification. And we have measurements and we can have statistics, but statistics is not proper science. Science is cases, clinical cases, case descriptions. So there's a very different epistemology on the side of Freud, which is very personal epistemology, which Freud develops over time, but which also has a, I think, which also doesn't change very, very much after a certain point, which stays in place and which then at a certain point has to be defended against the Zurich people when they become too annoying in 1913-14 with the Great Break. And I think this moment is very important. This is also the end of the book, because it's important because I would say that what Freud is doing is a kind of experimentalism in its own right. There's something that is still separate from this kind of Zurich experimental model, and this is built on dreams, writing down dreams, but then also cases. So what most of it you have very well described in many essays about Freud and his. But the question is there something as a Freudian epistemology? I have a question maybe to you. Turn this around.
I think I've got an escape act here now, which is to open it up to questions from everyone.
Because personally, I was never convinced there was in this kind of French sense of an epistemology, but there is something very, well,
Well, I mean, I think it's really interesting, the model you've, the historical model you put forward, that there's one set of experimental techniques very much associated with hypnotism, Salpêtrière, but also more disseminated. And then you do have this other set of experimental techniques associated with brass instruments, psychology of more German sort, you might say. Those are disseminated throughout Europe by then. And is there, you know, where does psychoanalysis track between those two? And you're saying, well, there's already a distinctive psychoanalytic epistemology, say, by 1900.
But the question is how official or inofficial it was.
Or how conscious?
Or how conscious, given...
Deliberate?
So much is elaborated with fleece, so that, and kind of secretly, or then shared with privileged disciples later, then there's this kind of sharing, right, then there's with Ferenczi, and with, it's a distributed, shared, distributed, but only in parts, so that, which is part of this intricate master model that Freud adopts, where he's sharing certain things but not others with certain disciples, which would be a different book and story, also interesting to do.
Yeah. Let's open it up now to a more general discussion and questions.
I may have misunderstood what you're saying, but I was a bit puzzled when you seem to see Freud as continuing the model of the master doctor who's in control of the clinical situation and who, as it were, sets its terms and brings his agenda to the patient. Because my understanding being very much that Freud had to learn not to do that and learn that from his patients, his hysterics, who, in a sense, from... It's embedded in the Anna O case, I guess, but in the other cases in with Breuer and in the other cases in Studies in Hysteria, the doctor had to learn to stand back and to listen. And though he takes one of the two things he takes from Charcot that he acknowledges is that moment in the Grand Attack of the attitude passionnelle, which is translated wonderfully by Strachey, when Strachey translates Freud's German equivalent as scenes of passionate movement, that third moment in the Grand Attack. But he then listens to that speech, whereas though in the La Salpêtrière, mockingly, the patient's balladage, their chatter, was taken down at great length and written out, but it wasn't interpreted and listened to in the way that Freud is almost forced to listen to the discourses of the great hysterics he's kind of encountering. So that they then, in some sense, set the agenda for what happens in the clinical situation. He can't start the session as he was wont to do in his master doctor's work, with asking questions and, you know, we'll work on this symptom and we'll work on that symptom, that he has to sort of learn to back off in some way. And however, the registre he remains in sorts of other ways, that in that clinical exchange, the patient's discourse and their acting out sets the agenda in a way. And, and so along with that, he gives up, doesn't he, the role of the suggester. There's that moment when Elizabeth R. complains really angrily that he's taken away some of her memories. There's certain things she can't remember because he's told her in hypnosis, you will forget this. and that, which is the direct opposite of what the psychoanalytic technique gradually learns to become. Not that you will forget this and you'll wake up and won't remember it, but you wake up and you will remember it and we will work through it together and integrate it. So it does seem to me I'm puzzled by when you see Freud, his clinical exchanges, to somehow maintaining that position of the kind of the master doctor in control. Because I think, however, as I say, however, Neurochisi is in all sorts of sorts of other ways. He has to learn, you know, to give over initiative to the patient. You know, it's the patient who starts the session, and what they talk about is whatever comes up in the session, rather than the doctor's agenda of, you know, we'll work on your sixth symptom today or whatever it might be.
Yeah, well, certainly there are. But there are many features in the practice or in the interaction of Freud with his patients that are, where we don't see him in the role of the master doctor, but still, I mean, the model, I mean, the setup is asymmetrical and has to be. I mean, this is one of the, this does not mean that Freud is always the master and the role of the master, what is going on. But the asymmetry is, and even the, I mean, when you think of the technical papers, Freud lengthily writes about Übertragungsliebe, so the transfer of love, is basically the descendant, I mean, clearly the descendant of suggestibilité, so what the way, I mean, the patient would respond to the hypnotist, so being suggestible and bringing some, well, faith or credence towards
the doctor. It's not the kind of suggestion that, as I understand it, Bernheim or the other practitioners of the Nancy school practice, which was the, and which Freud himself did in the very early days when he went back to Vienna, which is really to say, you will feel this, you will do that, when you wake up, you won't remember this, in other words. Whereas, he had to give that up.
Yeah.
And obviously he was under pressure from his patients to stop doing that sort of thing.
But that's a very, I mean, that was a very rough model that, also in the case of Bernheim, apparently did only work with certain patients, and were difficult to use in private practice. I mean, there's an entire reflection already by Bernheim on the varieties of the procedure of suggestion, that you have to vary the procedure. So that's what is crucial for Libaud, that the way in which you speak during the suggestion, the tone you adopt, is crucial that the suggestion will work on the patient or not. And this is something that is taken up in the 1890s by many followers of Libaud and Bernheim, who vary the suggestions in a way as to accommodate the patient in a setting that is very homely, that is very caring, that is adjusted to his or her own individuality. And this is what Vogt and these people are doing, or Wetterstrand. They're all kind of Bernheimians. And this is happening at the same time when Freud and Breuer publish studies on hysteria. And so there's clearly a model that is quite similar. I mean, this is very individualizing, very intricate, and which is not about taking away memories. It's not this very rough, primitive model, but which is building also a relationship of trust with the patient, to train the patient to perform the act, the entire act, on himself or herself. So doing away with, as much as one can, with an authoritarian model of hypnosis, whereas the model stays very, very asymmetrical. Also, I mean, in the case of Vogt, because it's called discipline, I mean, it's kind of self-discipline is the idea, but behind is always the model of the hypnotist, which is the model of, a kind of model of self-hypnosis that the patient is supposed to emulate, which is very different from Charcot and Bernheim, because self-hypnosis doesn't exist in the French clinics, because there's a social ontology in the clinic where they clearly distributed roles. There's the doctor, there's the patient. The patient can never be the doctor. I mean, there can never be an exchange of roles, so this is clearly impossible. So,
Lisa.
Yeah.
I was worried, too, about the master-patient relationship and the disappearance of hypnosis, because that relationship had changed politically. Because if that were the case, then it probably wouldn't have disappeared well into the Second World War, where certainly in Germany you still had, and if you think of the culture of the time, expressionist films and so on, I mean, you have a very, very clear sense of hypnosis as something which is a political mind-washing act, and yet in the clinic it's gone. Okay, so it's there in the general culture, but it's no longer there in the clinic. So why does it disappear in the clinic? So the political answer is not a good enough answer.
Yeah.
And I was wondering whether, I mean, I'm just throwing this out, I have no idea whether this is the case, but I was wondering whether it had disappeared in as a clinical method. A, because with Bernheim, a lot of his patients were working class. I mean, they were ordinary people.
Right.
And in Schapur, Freud's case, a lot of them were women. And in both cases, you had a kind of growing discontent with authority vis-a-vis both those two groups. So maybe that's part of it. I mean, I just put that on the table. It's a possibility.
But I mean, hypnosis does not really completely disappear clinically. I mean, in the 20th century.
But it comes back. In the 20s, you don't hear about it.
Well, in Britain, it does. I mean, it's still. I mean, there are all those mixtures of hypnosis with other forms of psychotherapies.
You mean with war neuroses?
Yes, you have the war neuroses, you have Simmel. I mean, Simmel is a kind of a. He's using hypnosis, the psychoanalytic Simmel, Ernst Simmel.
I don't think suggestion hypnosis to me are the same.
Okay,
I mean, I think there's quite a. When I read the descriptions to me, there seems to be quite a break. I mean, suggestion is something in every medical encounter. When I go to my GP, suggestion is going on. Thank goodness, if there weren't any, it would be really bad. No possibility of cure at all, of any kind, not even for. But hypnosis is kind of more extreme as a method.
Right.
Am I wrong?
No, but the question is about what, in the post-Bernheimian landscape of hypnosis in the 20th century, I mean, this.
I suspect. I threw in the term suggestive therapeutics because that's a very standard term. About 1905 onwards in the English language. And it does overlap with psychotherapy. And everyone who's doing psychotherapy knows they're in the game of suggestive therapeutics. Now, whether they actually have gold watches which go like that, or whether they close the blinds and say you will go into a sleep while when you hear the voice behind you say 10. whether they actually do that.
There's somnolence and sleep. I think it's quite a radical difference.
But suggestive therapeutics, I mean, all of the, out of the First World War, in my view, comes the view that there's a huge panoply of methods you can use. So that, the famous example that, what's her name, in the three books about rivers in the First World War. Pat Barker's books. So she takes the extreme version of Yeland, who uses extremely high electrical impulses to cure people of aphonia. And he just mounts the electricity until it works. She takes that from a real case history of suggestive therapeutics. Because Yeland is under no illusion that using electricity is anything other than suggestion. So it's a variety of suggestion and hypnosis, whether it's got, the dramatic trappings. It's just suggestive therapeutics by 1910, 1920, particularly by 1920. But I introduced a red herring, which I still believe, because the people who turn up for the International Congress on Hypnotism are far fewer by 1910 than they were in 1890 or 1902. I think that's when the third conference was, the International Conference. So what's going on there? Are they all shifting away? They say, oh, hypnotism is no longer this refined experimental technique because it's all been taken over by suggestive therapeutics. Instead of an experimental model, we're in the clinical field and we're just looking at the efficacy of clinical techniques. Is that what has happened?
It is important, isn't it, to remember that for Charcot, hypnotism was like a didactic technique for exhibiting certain things in the lecture room. You know, he'd bring on Langevin or whoever, and they'd go through their paces, and he would switch paralysis from left to right and then wake them up or whatever. But he warned against using it as a clinical technique, even though he schematized it into the grand hypnotism, as if it was a kind of parallel to the grand attack. He warns against doing that. So when Freud goes off and starts translating Bernheim and becoming fascinated briefly with the Nancy school, in a way he's being naughty, as of Charcot,
yeah. Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
And Charcot rebukes him.
No, but Freud writes Freud translates Bernheim, but adds a preface that is very pro-Charcot and skeptical about Bernheim, because Freud thinks that if you say suggestion and X, Y, you say simulation, and then you destroy the ontology of mental illness, but still then nothing is left to do, and then the cause of be it hypnosis or suggestion is lost, because then you're on the other side, then you're being too radical, so you have to stay with the, so that, this is an attitude that has been taken by many people who criticize psychotherapy and say, well, actually these people are not ill, it's they may be a bit deluded, but they're not really sick. I mean, it's just a good talk or a kind of Socratic conversation. I mean, this was persuasion, Dubois. So it means when people find out that they are just imaginary, they're just malade imaginaire, they will find out through a good reasoned conversation with their doctor, then there will be no mental illness. That also had its moment, the Dubois moment. Dubois was one of the most very, very famous psychotherapists between 1895 and 1910, and then, I think, when did he die? 12 or 10 or so, and then, well, basically he's gone, there's no school. I mean,
questions further back.
You should be in a high position. You should be authoritarian in your patients, otherwise it doesn't work, unfortunately. But if you aim to work as a psychodynamic, psychoanalytical therapist, so it's hard to run. So therefore,
did everyone hear this very interesting question? You did.
Like,
And the neurologist? Which, so the neurologist is more like the psychodynamic therapist or more like the hypnotherapist?
None of them. It comes from the pure side. Medical doctors.
But if you think of, for instance, Charcot, who is a neurologist, and to him, hypnosis is part of neurology. It's not something that's different from neurology.
But initially he uses it as a diagnostic tool, doesn't he? To diagnose hysteria.
Yes.
If you're susceptible to hypnosis,
yes,
you must be hysterical.
Yes.
I think he attributed too much potential to it in the beginning. They thought this gives you a nexus. Subconscious gives you a nexus and you get an answer there. And then they realize that you don't. Unfortunately. And therefore they get
the way hypnosis, as I understand it, works more in with Charcot is, yes, he uses it to dramatize his hysterics, but he does, when he gives an account of trauma and post-traumatic effects and the incubation period, he sees the patient as being in a state of shock, which is sort of auto-hypnotic. And he talks about that. That's where I think Breuer gets his hypnoid states from. It sounds very like Charcot, and briefly Freud agrees with him and then breaks very strongly over the necessity for hypnoid. For Charcot, it's something that's inherited. A disposition to this is inherited. Yeah. And there's this real tension in his work between his favourite metaphor of the terrorist who plants a bomb, the agent provocateur, which he uses again and again as a metaphor, and the notion of being something inherited predisposition to be auto-hypnotic, to be susceptible to that. So hypnosis is on the side of the patient in that sense. It's part of the condition of hysteria. But he does warn against attempting to use it as a curative clinical disease.
Andres, do you want to respond further to the question about the three-headed professional here
to hear more about the reason or about the practice, what in the practice leads you to the
I thought you said you do.
I said it can't.
You said there are two completely different things, three even. And if I do one, I have to forget the other two. I mean, there are cases of, even famous cases of psychoanalysts who became hypnotists. Like François Roustan is a very famous case, even more interesting because he was first a Jesuit. He was a Jesuit who became a psychoanalyst and then a hypnotist. And he still is a hypnotist at his age 95 or so.
There's a journal of neuropsychoanalysis and a school of neuropsychoanalysis.
Exactly, yes, who claim that, but that's it,
Any other questions?
I have a question. You have a question.
Yes, please, Lisa, go ahead.
So, I was curious when you were talking about the word association tests, what this experiment should be. And I recently happened to come across this talk that Freud gave to the lawyers.
Mm-hmm.
In which he talks about word association in quite explicit terms. He likes this. I mean, he thinks it's a good way of pointing out that there is an unconscious, that there are instinctual impulses, and you can get through this test. And it struck me as you were talking that this was another diagnostic tool. Mm-hmm. So word association, like hypnosis, becomes a diagnostic tool rather than a way towards therapeutic ends. So it's him with his experimenter's hat on. And that's quite important. I mean, that it's not necessarily useful as a technique towards any kind of therapy, but it's useful as a technique to analyze what's going on with the patient.
But I think this text is interesting. It's quite interesting because this text at the same time is a criticism of the potential uses of the word association test in the court. It says, well, then in the end, he will have a neurotic and he'll make up all sorts of things.
Yes, he doesn't think it's useful in courts.
So for the court, it's not useful. But it proves somehow the existence of the unconscious. That's very useful. The same for hypnosis. And Freud, in his, I think, very last lectures he wrote up, I mean, this fragment, which is in the last volume of the collected works, he starts out and says, well, what is the unconscious? We have an experimental proof. And the experimental proof is hypnosis. It's Charcot and Bernheim, and this is the proof that the unconscious exists. But there, the story about hypnosis stops, and then we move on to metapsychology, to the unconscious in the Freudian sense. But still, so he keeps this reference historically, but also in some way, not just historically. So that's very interesting. It's very intriguing, but he discards it still for practical, therapeutic or other uses. So that
you said in your presentation, this is not a story about the winners and losers. I read the book when it came out 10 years ago in Germany. The first thing I picked up is that the characters, as you lay out very carefully, I mean, they are involved in all kinds of rivalries and discussions tend to revolve around intellectual supremacy and legitimacy and all of that, which may be also a reflection of how the European landscape at the time was divided. And you yourself often refer to Charcot's experiments as the French model. So I think there is a political dimension here. But the question is that, with hindsight, there is one person here who comes out as the winner, and it's Freud. There are Freudians, but where are the Krafteddians, the Vogtians, we don't have them, right? And maybe they do exist, but I'd say, 100 years down the line, Freud managed to establish, with his Science of the Unconscious, a movement that is still very controversial, but also popular at the same time. So he said, what is it, what was it that allowed him to do that, despite the fact that when he imported the so-called French model into Viennese society, he was perceived by Krafteddian and others as, persona non grata, to some extent. Maybe I'm exaggerating.
Well, I don't know. But Krafteddian, is interesting because Krafteddian tries his hand at hypnotism and, I mean, he fails spectacularly with this public scandal around him, and he dies embittered in Graz already forgotten. But I mean, Krafteddian has a very successful afterlife through his famous book, The Psychopathia Sexualis, which was a bestseller already at his time, and still is a book that I think you can buy. So he's not dead. I mean, Bleuler to many is a great and venerated psychiatrist, especially if you go to Switzerland. So they're not all. So I think, depending on how you put the focus, you can find, you could say, winners, or you could see figures emerging in a distinctive, creating their distinctive brand, I could say, or school. And so clearly, if the focus had been put on Jung, for instance, the result would have been a different one. But maybe even more complicated to write, because it's not clear how you go from the word association test to the mandala and the archetypes and the collective unconscious and all that. It's a different geography that is partly overlapping with the Freudian geography, with the geography of hypnotism.
I think also this book really stops before there is a psychoanalytic movement.
Yeah.
Though it depends what you think of the psychoanalytic movement is. Is it kind of a bunch of enthusiasts who are trying it out here, there, and everywhere? Is that what the psychoanalytic movement is? Or is it this tightly organized professional body of, you know, with training rules and 4 years before you can call yourself a psychoanalyst, that kind of, which the people who are in the training institutes think that they are the movement, whereas the three people called Ernest Jones, practicing psychoanalysis in London in 1922, you know, one of them was the guy who wrote to Freud, but there were these other two who used the coincidence of names to make a few quid. Is that the psychoanalytic movement? Or the man who in 1912 was practicing psychoanalysis in Zakopane, where Malinowski was a young anthropologist, and he had a friend who committed suicide, another friend who had a disastrous love affair. They were having psychoanalysis with this guy who just set up practice in 1912. No hint of Freud or anything. Contact. So where's the psychoanalytic movement? I mean, you really don't move into that question, because, you know, maybe the psychoanalytic movement in the formal training sense was a terrible mistake, and it's a terrible idea that Freudians exist. I mean, Einsteinians don't exist because physics moves on, whereas Freudians are completely stuck. With their veneration for this father figure and their domination by him. There's a wonderful moment that I discovered in doing the history of psychoanalysis in America. In 1921, the American Psychoanalytic Association considered the question of disbanding themselves. 1921. Why? Because Freud's ideas were so well disseminated that they had no reason to exist anymore. Everyone knew about Freud. He was a bestseller. Doctors, you didn't need to tell anyone. So why bother to meet with an American psychoanalytic association? Now, it really raises an interesting question. Well, why do they need to meet, carry on meeting?
So they can discuss the latest film.
Right, is that what we should do next?
but it's the popular culture side which sort of follows Freud and psychoanalysis far more acutely than, say, following Krafft-Ebing, even though Krafft-Ebing may be used by more psychiatrists in America. Mm. To me, that's an intriguing question, too. Mm. It's another site of a different unconscious. Mm.
Yes, I think maybe we'll wind up things on the formal side of us sitting here. Let's thank Andreas particularly for being here, for wanting to talk about his book and for being so enlightening. And we'll have a drink and wish him well and, of course, acquire his book. So, thank you very much.